Coming up next is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with Jerry Pives.
Welcome to this special Christmas edition of Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair. I'm Jerry Pives, a registered psychotherapist in Wanaka. And from that introductory music of Alan Parsons' Psycho Babble track, you may have already guessed that once again, I have convened my wonderful Psycho Babble panel to discuss the issue of just how are we going to manage these Christmas dinner conversations across the table. My wife's Dutch grandmother had a saying that guests and fish only last 3 days. Guests and fish only last 3 days. So just how do we navigate, yet again, conversations with people that may have cancelled us, othered us, or just plain excluded us from the family? Of course, if you've listened to any of my Real People shows over the last year, yep, I just earned my year one spurs, then you will know that my motto is for you to grab the oxygen mask first before trying to influence or change or just plain help other people along the path. And you see, since the outbreak of COVID mandates and massive government overreach, most of us who listen to RCR have been bravely facing up to some of the greatest horrors in the history of the world. Horrors that have made us, and certainly made me, wish over and over again that I was wrong. But we're not wrong. We've done our research. And we found out that, you know, when you stop drinking the PsyOps Kool-Aid, the scales drop from our eyes. And we realize that we have witnessed global medical malfeasance on a scale that is frankly unimaginable. Not only that, but we have seen political corruption and messaging that is in lockstep all around the globe, which points to a controlling supernatural force hiding in the shadows. We've seen mainstream media captured by corrupt state-funded politicians who are following said hidden and sometimes not so hidden secret agendas, doing the bidding of their hidden masters. We've woken up to the reality of government-funded academic malevolence that has been following a secretive Marxist ideology to destroy the family and sow division across society. We've also seen the government funding of an inaccurate and one-sided fear narrative that the planet is going to boil away. We've even watched blatant satanic worship at the Olympic opening and closing ceremonies. You'd have to have been blindfolded and in order not to see that. We've learned of the overriding prevalence of child trafficking. And on the subject of satanic influences, we have learned of the horrifying prevalence of child trafficking and paedophilia amongst these very same top politicians, ministers, and Hollywood stars. And then there is the secret and not so secret pollution of our atmosphere and our water, coupled with incomprehensible attacks and restrictions on our farmers, and the determined attempt to remove democracy, free speech, and human rights from our population. Some list, eh? So just what do we talk about to our family and friends over Christmas, those who are still walking around blindfolded and with builder's cement apparently stuck in their ears? Which is why I keep emphasizing our need to first take care of ourselves, grab the oxygen mask of sanity by spending time together with like-minded souls. That's what RCR is all about, speaking the truth. And we need to reach out and hug each other and keep hold of our humanity, our compassion, and our resilience. You know, we need to eat together, sing together, and meet up as often as possible to bring our nervous systems into a calm and regulated state. And only in that state can we be any use to anyone at all. But it is Christmas. And I asked my wonderfully qualified Psycho Babble panel, How can we understand what is really going on across the Christmas table, and how can we cut across the crap, to be honest? So I invite you to listen in to the highly qualified lifetime doctor and psychiatrist, René de Monchy from Tauranga, one of the founding members of NZDSOS, New Zealand Doctors, Speaking Out with Science, and also to the recently defrocked child psychologist from the east coast of Australia and founding member of the Byron Lighthouse Declaration, Dr. Ros Neelan-Cook, and myself, a lifetime therapist and psychotherapist, as we unpack the thorny issue of how to not only survive Christmas, but even perhaps make it a truly healing experience for everyone. And, you know, we call ourselves the Psychobabble Panel deliberately to poke fun at ourselves. Normally, the term psychobabble refers to the very worst pop psychology you can come across. But here, the truth is, you will struggle to find more genuine and in-depth psychological knowledge and clinical experience amongst any three people anywhere in the world. It's hardly psychobabble. But if you can't poke fun at yourself, you really ain't going to make it through these awesome years of seismic change, a period in history that we are actually all privileged to be living through and contributing to. So after our panel's Christmas music choice for today, you're going to hear some really exciting conversations in which we discuss a remarkable event on Christmas Day during the First World War in France and what it can teach us. You'll learn what hostile attribution effect really means and why humour is actually central not only to our survival, but to our very humanity. And what on earth could the significance be of a train that travels all the way from London to Vladivostok? But first, let's soothe our nervous systems with Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. And I invite you just to stop what you're doing and get up with me and join in with me in doing some air conducting to this beautiful piece of music by Yuichi Sakamoto. And hear the deep optimism behind this piece of music. I believe it is a powerfully emotional and optimistic message that no matter how dark everything may get, love and truth will always conquer. It's the Psychobabble Panel, the three lifelong dedicated psychological therapists who can laugh at themselves and call themselves the Psychobabble Panel. And Ros, you were saying you think it's quite important that we can laugh at ourselves.
I think it is probably the most important human ability. I really do. And I think especially at the moment, because it's something we seem to have lost. There are so many of those famous philosophers. I can't remember who. Confucius said it. Plato said it. I think Socrates said it. They didn't talk about laughing about themselves so much, but their general point was wisest are those who understand they don't know everything.
Yeah.
Who can look at their own shortfallings. And that's the point where I would inject laugh at their own shortcomings, because it just makes it so much easier.
I'm sure Oscar Wilde would have come out with something like, the only wise person is someone who knows they're stupid.
That's right.
He was famous for these wonderful juxtapositions, you know. Yeah.
That's exactly it. But the point I was going to raise, because it really does seem as though that ability has gone. People seem to be in this state of arousal where any potential incoming information is dangerous and has to be sort of taken through a filter of, is this dangerous to me? People's level of alarm is much higher. They're sort of their internal fire alarm, as I call it, their sort of whole defense system, their amygdala, it's scanning for more danger. It's more sort of highly primed. One of the examples, I think it's a really great example that helps people understand. I wrote my second thesis on violent video games and aggression. The interesting point that has come out of all of this literature research on violent video games over the years is that the one very, very robust result, regardless of how this is analyzed, is a widespread increase in what we call hostile attribution effect. Are you familiar with that term? Hostile attribution effect. I'll give you the example. If you've got teenagers at school who are walking down the hall, let's go with our 14 and 15-year-old boys because they're always the sort of bubbliest. So one of them's walking down a hall. He's got his bag over his shoulder and he accidentally knocks into another child, another teenager. What's increased is that decades ago, you had a far higher likelihood of the person who was bumped into to say, oh, no worries, mate, that's all right. Whereas now the hostile attribution effect has increased so much that the person bumped into will see it as a specific direct attack and turn around and want to take reparative action, isn't the right word, but fight back. Basically,
retribution.
And that's where we have seen so many more fights breaking out in schools, so many more fights. I don't know if it happened in New Zealand, but we had this absolute tragedy of what they were calling king hitting, one hit sort of deaths, where this sort of thing was happening. Someone would turn around, a boy would turn around, punch the other one in the face, which of course happens in all of this media all the time and doesn't seem to affect people. But actually, if you take someone out full force in the face and they go back, they have a very high likelihood of dying. And it was happening. So they brought in some law here called, I don't know, something or other about one punch, king hitting. But it's that. So this hostile attribution effect where everyone is in a place of feeling as though they're in more danger, people are far more likely, and especially those that consume violent media, to see that as an attack. And so they will immediately go back on the attack. And I think that example, which is pretty easy to understand within violent video games, is what we've got within the COVID situation, this sort of new world situation with our families, with all these really divided relationships, where people are almost expecting that punch. So they're ready, like a boxer, with their fists up to respond, which is not how we should be.
So I'm gonna bring Rene in just 1 second, because I know I want to hear what you have to say about this, Rene. But just before I do that, doesn't this mean, Roz, that on the basis of what you've just said, that over the Christmas dinner table, when someone we're talking to from the family member or your good old friend or whatever, when we're with them, we should not believe the apparent calmness of their demeanor, their appearance of social ease. We should understand, we should treat them with the gentleness that we would treat someone who's just walked in and been in or seen a car accident. Like they are on the edge. So one of the messages I'm wondering that we're conveying is there's no point pretending that the people you're talking to have a resilient nervous system. They are on edge. They have been aroused, not in a sexual way, but in a threat way by years of fear. And therefore, you must really treat them with the same gentleness and soothing that you would a beloved family member who's been traumatized. They are a victim of trauma. Have I got this right?
Yes.
I also,
and people might not like this, but it's how I feel about the whole sort of COVID years, is that we need to treat them absolutely in the way you've described, Jerry, but we also need to be aware that they are operating emotionally, unconsciously, almost from that level of a very defended teenager, adolescent, who has those barriers up that are going to come up very, very quickly and without conscious intention. So we do have to handle them very, very carefully. And that's hard. to hold that space.
And I'm coming, Rennie, I'm coming to you, but I just want to share a little example of that. Yesterday, I was talking to my grown-up son. He's 36 years old, all right? And boy, was he a teenager. I mean, was he a he did teenager like a master, you know, he really did it. And I could just walk in the room and sneeze and that would be it. Why was I this awful dad? You know, so I was the side of the and you know, it's taken until yesterday for me to turn around and say to him, son, I really love you. But sometimes you're a complete bastard. You're really impossible to be with. And when you're like that, we all know that. And we just keep away from you because you're like a bear with a sore head. But when you're like this, because he was open, I said, I love you. And you're so lovely to be with. And you know, I'll take both. So that was 36, age 36. So what's that? He was doing that at 11 and 12. He started early. So that's like 21 years it's taken me to be able to say to him, I love you. And you behave badly sometimes, you know.
Can I ask, Jerry, I'm curious, sorry, René, I know you want to talk, but this is a really important point. Do you model your own bastardry in front of him? Because that's the other really important thing, is to own our own foibles when we fall into that space ourselves and say, oh, my God, I really got triggered then. Whatever language you use, because when you do that in front of others, that frees them up and removes some of the defenses, maybe not immediately in the situation, probably not, but over time where they can do it themselves.
Well, my first response was, what on earth do you mean? You know, how could I possibly have any bastardry in me? No, that's just the first defense. It's automatic. It's I would call it script bound. And I see it because I've done a bit of work on myself, and then I have a little laugh. And then actually one of the things, it brings us right back to humor, is one of the ways I do that is I absolutely capture it with humor, and I often ham it up. You know, I'll often make it more absurd, you know, how unreasonable can I get, you know, and I will get people laughing about it because not only will I see it, but I will make a joke of it. Because actually in my system, in my psyche, one of the best ways to disempower the parts of me that think so seriously of themselves and take themselves so pompously and so seriously is to just put a rubber nose on them, or put a reindeer head on them, or put a Zorro mask on them and just start having a laugh. You know, that completely dissolves the power of those introjects upon me, you know. So that's, yeah.
I suppose from a medical point of view, how I do that is actually to imagine them without any clothes on. And then you have whatever the arrogance or whatever the pompousness is, then I feel a bit like the emperor has no clothes.
Well, René, you gave us a beautiful example of this on our last Psychobabble, because you talked about how you walked in to this A&E session, or this extreme emergency session, and dealing with a woman that didn't want any male doctors. And you said, well, you know, I'm afraid you're going to have to talk to this, I don't know, 180-year-old white male fart, you know. I can't remember. I've exaggerated, but, you know, and it was a beautiful example of what Roz was saying, which is actually, you know, I'm gonna nail it, name it, and then I'm gonna take all the clothes off it and have a laugh at it, you know.
Ooh.
So René, we've been shutting you up for the last 10 minutes. What do you want to say about this subject?
I have essentially nothing to say. So I think it's fascinating to listen to you, because I think this idea of that middle realm, that realm of the heart, actually of where communication, genuine communication, actually is. Because we were talking about pompousness or non-real self, but the real self is really that genuine, vulnerable, humoristic part that can look at him or herself, laugh at him or herself, and yet take him or herself very serious at the same time. And so what we were talking about just before, and I wonder if I can make quite a big strange loop, because it seems as if it's not related. Yesterday, I listened to an interview in Holland, or in Dutch rather, by a doctor who apparently was born, as turned out in the interview, in the same place that I was. And she was talking about this whipped up East-West controversy, which might well lead to a Third World War. And it reminded me so much what she said and what I experienced. When I drove as a young child in the late 40s, early 50s, when my father drove us in, as a family, on the way from the East-West road from Amsterdam to Germany, which is very close to where I lived, then he would say, you know, I want you to realize you're actually on the road between London and Moscow, and you're in the way between London and Vladivostok, which I just quickly looked. London-Vladivostok is 12,000 kilometers. London-Moscow is about 3,000 kilometers. Now, then going back to the interview where this woman said that she was on the station in Hengelo, where I was born, and I remember exactly having had the same feelings. And she said there she was on the platform and she saw this enormous train, much longer than the train station. And there you had these blue wagons and they had on them CCCP. They were Russian trains. And they were going indeed from Amsterdam to Moscow and to Vladivostok. And that was, and then later you had the Cold War. And I was thinking that going through all these countries with all these people who were all having families, who were actually all have the same ideals of peace, living together, being able to manifest themselves. The one comes from London, is going to Moscow, where they're absolute polar opposites, and they're actually in the Cold War with 200 kilometers to the east of where I lived. You had the Pershing rockets from the Americans against the Russian rockets. So you had this train going through all these areas with all these different people, all these different countries that were more or less at war with one another. And that brings me right back to what Ross said this morning, that you had the First World War. These people were in the trenches, they fought each other, millions and millions of slaughter, actually just the most brutal, machinated war of slaughter.
The first industrial slaughter of humans, yep.
And many have followed, unfortunately, after that.
It was the industrial scale of it, wasn't it, that was shocking? That was new.
Yeah. Yeah. So you didn't have any blood on your hands anymore by literally killing the person with your own sword, but it was a machine gun. And then it was Christmas time. And what they had done, there was this one day of truce, and Ross said it. And out of the trenches came the German soldiers. And out of the trenches, just 100 meters or 200 meters to the west, came the English soldiers, British soldiers. And they played soccer together. They played football together. And they sang Holy Silent Night, Holy Night, in German and in English. That, for me, means that actually all that we have in the way of animosity and warlike atmosphere is all whipped up, manipulated stuff. Mm-hmm. And I saw that also the atmosphere of Christmas, that we can have that. Mm-hmm. Because that is actually what we talk about, this inner part, this genuine part of us, this nurturing vulnerability in the Christmas story of the child within us. And that is where the it speaks to the poorest shepherd's heart, because it speaks to the heart. It enlightens the heads of kings who come on the 6th of January. So it means that for all generations, if we can come into that atmosphere of genuineness, of wonder and goodwill, then there is indeed a peace on earth. We can do that. And then I was, yeah, so that was one thing. Another thing was this morning, every Saturday morning, I go to a cafe and have two eggs on toast and a coffee, and I read the newspaper. This is my ritual. And there are actually about five people who do the same, so we become really sort of friends. And I was reading this morning an article in the New Zealand Herald about RFK, Robert Kennedy Jr. And it said, is he a crusader or is he a crackpot? And this whole article was actually so negative, so denigrating, that he had been a drug addict in his teenage years and all of that. And nothing was good about him. And then I saw that it was literally taken from the New York Times. So if we lose that middle realm of actually independent, genuine thinking and feeling and expressing ourselves, then we come in immediately, automatically, as a defense in that dualistic thinking of us and them. And then I can either become quite oppositional, or I can, in the freeze or fight or flight reaction, but I've actually lost my humanity.
Yes.
And in that one particular instance during the First World War, in this incredible inhumanity, there was that one little moment of inner peace, and that light moment. And we are now exactly in the same situation, where instead of wanting to make peace in the world, it is this manipulation of thinking it's inevitable that we get a third world war, or it's inevitable that we have nuclear war and all of that. Because we let ourselves be manipulated into this dualistic thinking of us and them, and that is of the past, that has no place anymore in our consciousness.
Couldn't agree more, Rennie. Beautiful. I love the way you've brought the everything you've said, but I love the way you've brought this moment in history in World War One. And Roz, I think you had something you wanted to say about that. Am I right? Or
when we were talking about these divisions before, usually in the course of development, let's go back 50 years before media, social media, etc., really changed the entire trajectory of children's development. What we would expect to see is when children are in those early teenage years, when young people are in those early teenage years, so they're sort of beginning to become their own person, we expect them to defend, to fight their camp. It's the norm at that point for them to be very black and white in their thinking. But the next stage, and this is what we seem to be missing at the moment, and I will bring this back to World War One. The next stage is when they've had enough time, which they should on their own, to contemplate, yes, they will break through that and they will get into what Gordon Neufeld talks about, mixed feelings, understanding that it's okay to hold two different points at the same time. It's okay to be in a point of conflict and hold both of them. You don't have to have a right and wrong. But that doesn't come through until the later teenage years. And as we know, certainly the prefrontal cortex doesn't finish developing till mid-20s or even later 20s. At the highest orders, that can be later into those years. And I think what's interesting, yet in a tragic way, when we talk about that you know, sort of World War One, one of the reasons we have our soldiers at such an incredibly young age is because they don't have it yet. And it's very easy to tell a 17 and 18 year old boy, here's a gun, they're your enemy, go and blow their heads off. I mean, I've got goosebumps, it's disgusting. What I had heard about that situation on that Christmas as well was that apparently when they then ended the ceasefire and went back to fighting the next day, apparently a lot of them couldn't. Mm-hmm. And had to leave. But I think we really are in that situation where so many people are still operating. And I'm not saying it pejoratively. I'm saying it absolutely objectively. You can have an IQ of 180. You can have 1,000 letters after your name and still operate from that place of earlier teenage years where you can't hold those mixed feelings and mixed concepts. And that's pretty much where the majority of the planet is at the moment, I believe. Exactly as you described in that article about Robert F. Kennedy. I was reading a similar one yesterday about Jay Bhattacharya, who to me, I believe is, you know, a man of deep, deep integrity and a very good person. Yet, because the authors don't like his one position on vaccines, herd immunity, etc., everything that's written about him is damning. Right? There's nothing. They can't see the positive. And while we're in that place looking at people as either friend or foe, then we're really in trouble. And this is, again, why it's so important for us to be able to model our own inner fool, right? Laugh at ourselves and let other people see us laughing at ourselves. Openly discuss, particularly with COVID, openly discuss when we got things wrong. Oh, I remember when I used to think that. Gosh, I can't believe it, right? That frees other people who are stuck in that sort of dualistic position, black and white thinking. It makes it a little bit safer for them to soften. And until they soften, they can't unlock their really strong cognitive.
So good what you say, because I remember the title of an American movie called Girl Interrupted. Don't know if you remember that. That describes what later became known as borderline personality disorder, which is actually a terrible term.
Yes.
And it is really more and more is being replaced with complex PTSD, which I think it is.
Yes.
But this interruptedness in the development, because you said exactly that in the early adolescence, it is this lashing out or whatever. And then you grow up further when this prefrontal cortex is starting to develop, then you start to be able to have these various parts within yourself, recognizing them, and trying to come to a degree of peace with them. But if, because of the trauma, that development is actually not able to properly take place, then you have to seek the security into the either or. And that's exactly what we see. Now, the problem is that in all of us, it has nothing to do, by the way, with IQ, as you say. This is far more to do with EQ than IQ. Yes. But the problem is that in our development of consciousness where we're in, where this is supposed to happen, there is the manipulation to bring us into the regressive dualistic state. And that is, of course, where then you ask, well, what is behind this? And why is this so deliberately and so detailed chosen as attacks onto our own genuine human being?
Let me slow this down. I want to just capture what we've been saying, and I want to just make sure that I've got this. At least I want to share my understanding of what we're saying. I really like the fact that you used the word regression, Rene, and I like the fact that it wasn't that we were interrupted in our development, but this is a place we return to at a core primal kind of security survival basis. So it's not that we're underdeveloped, or anyone who holds a black and white view is lacking some psychological developmental history, because I don't like that idea. I like the idea that we are fully developed humans who have been placed under extraordinary stress and pressure to make us or stimulate us or in some way aggravate us into a place of regressed survival mode. And we go into this black and white place. And what you ask is you know, why would anyone do that? You know, why would anyone want to create back to the kind of the culture, the environment we're living in, which is a psychologically manipulated culture? Why would anyone want to do that to human beings, to put them into this regressed, slightly animalistic phase, certainly a long way away from prefrontal cortex analysis, from being able to say, oh yeah, there's this side and there's this side. And you know, once upon a time I used to read the newspapers, for example. I used to sit down and read have a cup of coffee and read the newspapers and go, oh, that's interesting. We've got this side here and we've got this side here. And this is all very stimulating. I'm enjoying this. I don't know what my position is fully, but I'm enjoying some really well-informed people writing and interesting stuff. You know, and that was before we got the babbling post. You know, talk about babbling without any psychological, no psychobabblers here. We're talking about the babblers, where you've got a sheet of paper full of disaster, fear, and judgmental one-sidedness, at which point I stopped reading newspapers, you know. And so we're operating in an environment that is attacking our capacity to be in this middle realm, Renny. I loved it when you bring your body into our conversations. You keep remind. I know I'm the body worker, but you always remind me of our bodies. And you talk about this middle heart space. Right at the beginning, you were talking about the middle heart space, the train that travels through the animal to the thinking. That somehow that train running from London to Vladivostok, you know, is the connecting point between where we might keep being pushed or nudged, is the more accurate word, which is into these animalistic regressive states. But as human beings, we must find the heart. We must travel through the heart to find our rational human thinking, our complex ability to hold multiple realities, to understand that not one point will cover everything, that we have this idea of nuance, if you like, the place where we can contemplate nuance, and that it is through the heart I'm thinking we're talking about. And do you know what operated the heart in that World War I scenario that we keep referring to? It was the sound, because it was first the singing. They heard the Germans singing. What is the German for silent night?
Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht.
Beautiful. And the English started singing the English version. And it was through the sound. And I think this is really symbolic. That's why I wanted to come back to it, because sound is emotion. Sound connects us. You know, on my Real People, We do a conversation, which is lovely. We do reflections, which I think is lovely because it's me. And then that's an example of me taking the piss, because I don't want to take myself too seriously. But it gives me a chance to reflect in a very prefrontal cortex way. But then I ask my guests, I say, give me six pieces of music from different periods of your life. And what happens then is, as soon as we start talking about music, it's like then we connect with our emotions. And I can connect emotionally with the listener of the same piece of music. And there's something about the sounds. And I think of this as the sound was the beginning of creation. In the beginning was the word. God spoke and the world was created. Not through any action, through sound. And I think sound and vibration, however we like to talk of it, is at the center of our connection with the heart. And this image of these young men who've been aggravated into a state of hate by this military, the emergence in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, the very beginnings, the birth pangs of the military-industrial complex that is still trying to create a third world war right now, the emergence of that military-industrial complex and the psychological hatred that would have been generated in those young men. And then there is this moment on Christmas Eve of such stillness where they hear the sounds of the German soldiers. I'm getting quite emotional because it's that beautiful sound of a little baby. And the respect we give around a young baby, the hushness around the birth room, the sacred nature of energy around a new birth, and the vulnerability, the utter vulnerability of that baby. And when I hear that, and you think of those young boys, I think boys 17, 18, don't you?
Absolutely.
And I think of them hearing their mother's song in the middle of this war. And I think that's where we have to go. We have to go to the most vulnerable parts of us and our need for nurturance. We all need it, whatever our bloody opinions are. And across that Christmas dinner table, just see the vulnerable baby in yourself and in the people around you. And think of those soldiers reaching out, because that enabled them to get out of the trenches. It enabled them to play a common language of football. And the really important part was when the officers heard about it, they did everything they could to stop it because they knew these boys wouldn't fight again.
Because that is so good. And thank you for being emotional, because that is exactly what it is. That is where, in that silence of the heart, that's actually where morality lies. And if we would listen to that, we wouldn't actually even be able to make nuclear weapons, because something would stop us and say, I'm not wanting to be part of this. I'm not going to be part of the manufacturing of this. And not only of that, but similar, if there would have been any morality, then the pharmaceutical industry wouldn't have made any mRNA vaccines or technology. A gain of function of virulence, if you can keep that in your thought, then you have completely lost all morality in your thinking and your feeling.
Yeah.
May I make a suggestion? It would be beautiful to have some music right now. And what would be nicer than listening to Silent Night in German?
Yeah.
I think that's how we're going to bring this psychobabble panel to a close. That's a beautiful ending for our Christmas special. And what a piece of music for us to launch into. Renee, thank you so much. Roz, bless you and thank you so much. Well, I hope you enjoyed that Psychobabble panel Christmas special. And remember, I'd love to hear from you. If you can write in a message, let me know how you find what we're doing, how you're getting on with all this stuff, and anything you'd like us to talk about or me to talk about. And remember that in the Real People sessions, if you know someone who's doing great work for our community, then send me their email and I'll invite them onto Real People. It's not about famous people. It's just about ordinary Kiwis who are making a difference in their community. Let's have a listen and get to know them. Let's find out what makes them tick, what gets them out of bed in the morning, and how do they deal with stress and trauma. So this is me, Jerry Pives for RCR, signing off, wishing you and all your loved ones a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
You've been listening to Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with Jerry Pives.